Coming up, private genetic testing for a fee. Do you really want to know the diseases you're at risk for someday?
To be honest, in my initial reflection when I looked at this, I went, whoa.
And in France, a centuries-old tradition, the pilgrimage to the cathedral at Chartres.
I'm pretty tired, but other than that, it's invigorating.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome. I'm Kim Lawton, sitting in for Bob Abernethy. Thank you for joining us. Repercussions from the Gulf Coast oil spill dominated the news again this week. President Obama pushed BP to do a better job of resolving the crisis and taking responsibility for the damages. Meanwhile, religious groups have been holding a series of prayer vigils across the country. Participants are praying for an end to the environmental disaster. They're also offering prayers for those who've been most severely affected. The crisis has taken a devastating toll on people involved directly and indirectly in the fishing industry. Several faith-based groups have been mobilizing to provide assistance. Joining me now is Margaret Dubesson with Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of New Orleans. Margaret, thanks for being here. Tell us a little bit about the needs that you're serving right now.
Well, Kim, we have five centers set up in the fishing villages in the Archdiocese of New Orleans. We've seen about 8,000 people so far, fishermen and their families, who've come in just looking for help, looking for support, looking for financial assistance in some way. The BP claims process is a little cumbersome and it's going to take some time. So Catholic Charities has been able to provide direct assistance and food much more quickly and put that in the hands of the fishermen through these five emergency relief centers.
What about the emotional needs, the spiritual needs? I imagine that those are very difficult as well.
Kim, it is. We have seen about 8,000 people in our five centers, as I said. Many of those people are receiving mental health assessments where we ask very careful questions to see how they're feeling and how they're processing all of this. You may have heard this before, but this is much more than a loss of income for this particular group. This is loss of a way of life and a culture. And people are very fearful, very anxious, because no one knows how long this is going to go on. And the news just seems to get increasingly worse about it. So these fishermen and their families, who for generations have made their living as fishermen, as a very independent group, they're having a lot of difficulty dealing with the anxiety and uncertainty of the oil spill situation.
And what about for the broader community? Obviously, these people are directly, their livelihoods have been directly affected, but the greater area down there along the Gulf Coast, you all are still getting over Hurricane Katrina.
It's been almost 5 years since Katrina, and yes, we are still definitely in the recovery period of that. So this was an especially difficult blow at this time, coming up on this five-year anniversary, when a lot of people felt like we were just beginning to get our heads above water, so to speak, and making real progress toward the recovery. And then this oil spill comes. It's almost like Katrina all over again. And especially for the families of these fishermen, many of whom lost boats and homes in Hurricane Katrina, and then in Gustav and Ike a year later, this has been, a particularly difficult blow, a very, very anxiety-producing situation.
The churches down there are often the center for so much of the community. Do they have the resources they need to really deal with this crisis?
Well, we're making the resources available. We're going to find the resources. We are reaching out to people who would like to help us in that, and anyone who would like to help can visit our website, which is ccano.org, and we have a secure website and we're set up to take donations there. But Catholic Charities in the Archdiocese of New Orleans have been on the ground in these affected communities virtually since the beginning, like the Archbishop went out the weekend of that the spill occurred and met with parish leaders to find out, what do you all need us to do? He then gave Catholic Charities the green light to provide whatever services were necessary. And we've been doing that now for, I think it's 50-some-odd days now since the spill first began. And we've been providing services to the fishermen ever since. And we will continue to provide services until it's all over. And we'll find the resources that we need to do that.
All right, Margaret, thank you very much. Tensions remain high in the wake of Israel's deadly raid last week on a flotilla trying to break the blockade of Gaza. President Obama met with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and urged a recommitment to the peace process. As protests against Israel continued around the world, several Muslim and Christian groups pushed for an independent international investigation of the flotilla incident. Many Jewish groups stepped up their support for Israel. A coalition of Jewish politicians from many nations called for a meeting to counter what they called an effort to delegitimize Israel. After a visit to Cyprus last week, Pope Benedict XVI renewed his appeals for peace between Israel and the Palestinians. He urged a concerted international effort to resolve ongoing tensions in the Middle East. This week also marked the end of the Church's Year of the Priest. Some 15,000 priests gathered at the Vatican for celebrations. Benedict lamented that what should have been a year of joy for the priesthood had been marred by new revelations of clergy sex abuse. He begged for forgiveness from the victims and promised to do everything possible to ensure no more abuse occurs. Victims' rights groups, who were also in Rome, were unsatisfied by his comments and demanded more punitive action against abusive priests. Last month, the largest drugstore chain in the U.S., Walgreens, had planned to start selling over-the-counter DNA tests that would allow customers to assess their potential risk for various diseases. But those plans got postponed pending a Food and Drug Administration investigation. Several companies offer personalized genetic testing. But are the findings accurate? Can they really be kept private? And if you get bad news, how should it affect your life? Saul Gonzalez reports.
Unlocking and interpreting the secrets hidden in DNA used to be the province of scientists and medical researchers. But now it's a growing business, one that's selling genetic information directly to American consumers. Making a DNA test as easy to buy as housewares or clothing.
You know, I think for the history of man, people have always wanted to see something about their future. And now, through the power of genetics and genomics, we're able to look into the future in a science-based way.
But Jack Lord is the CEO of Navigenics. It's a California-based company that, for a fee of $999, offers its clients a personalized DNA test, one that pinpoints genetic markers indicating possible future threats to their health.
It's really simple. It's just some saliva that we collect. We analyze that and then give you a report that shows what your risks are compared to people in the population at large. So today we test for 28 conditions, and they range from chronic conditions like diabetes or heart disease to cancers like melanoma or prostate cancer or breast cancer, to other conditions that are generally silent disease, like glaucoma, macular degeneration, celiac disease, to Alzheimer's disease.
Navigenics is one of a growing number of new companies selling genetic tests directly to the public. All of them promise their clients better health and a better life by getting up close and personal with their DNA.
Once you log into the Navigenics site, you get a snapshot page here that just really outlines in these square boxes what you're at a high risk for, what you're at an average risk for, and what you're at a lower than average risk for.
Mike Godfrey, who works in corporate communications for a hospital in San Diego, is a Navigenics client. When he first got his DNA results back, Godfrey was surprised by his relative risk for several illnesses when compared to the rest of the population.
Diabetes, Alzheimer's disease, heart attack, brain aneurysm.
Atrial fibrillation, obesity.
Obesity. That's a would seem to be a lot to be worried about.
Graves' disease, which I never even heard of before. And so, to be honest, in my initial reflection when I looked at this, I went, whoa.
Four more, that's all you need.
Although he says he's not overly concerned, Godfrey's DNA test results have spurred him to think more about his health and spend a lot more time at the gym.
When you look through all those orange boxes that we went through and you take a look, almost all of them say that you should, you know, keep your weight down, that you should stay in shape, that you should eat better. It was validation to me that, yeah, that was the right move. Your money's being spent in the right place. The work that you're going through is going to be worth it in the end.
Lord says his company offers tests only for treatable or preventable illnesses, giving clients an edge in anticipating and avoiding future health problems.
And it's with that information that they can start to understand what they might do today to prevent an illness. If you know that in advance, you can start going to your doctor more frequently to be checked, or you might start a medication that prevents that condition much earlier than when you become symptomatic.
It doesn't say you're going to die, here's why. It says here are some things that you're prone to, and here's how you can prevent them from showing up in your body later.
Sarah Crosby Helms, another Navigenics client, discovered through her test that she had a higher than usual genetic risk for both colon cancer and Crohn's disease. The information got Crosby thinking about how much she really wanted to know about future threats to her health.
For me, I would rather know that I have this genetic predisposition than to not know. And if that means that...
Ignorance isn't bliss.
No, ignorance for me is not bliss.
The direct-to-consumer genetics testing industry says it promises its clients a glimpse over their healthcare horizon, warning them of possible dangers and threats to come. But critics aren't so sure. They worry that the technology is being oversold and that it raises a host of both ethical and public policy concerns.
We don't know everything about the relationship between genes and diseases, and even what we do know doesn't really tell you that much about what should you do now.
Alexander Capron is a professor of law and medicine at the University of Southern California and the former director of the ethics program at the World Health Organization. He's concerned that as genetic tests become more common, a growing number of people will overemphasize DNA as the road to a long life and personal happiness.
There are so many other things that are equally or more important, and that are actually things that we should be more concerned about in our environment, in our human relations, in social justice, so that all people have an opportunity to have a life in which they can flourish and so forth, and not just narrowly, well, what's your genetic code? I would also be aware that you could have some surprises that you really don't want to know, that you just as soon not have on your mind.
There are also concerns among some health experts about the regulation of direct-to-consumer DNA testing. Currently, no federal agency, such as the Food and Drug Administration or Federal Trade Commission, has come up with rules to monitor the company's marketing claims, testing practices, or the validity of results.
I think we're still in early days on the regulation side, and the FDA has more work to do here. The field has grown, I think, faster than anyone expected.
Worried about the licensing, utility, and accuracy of direct-to-consumer genetic tests, some states, such as California and New York, have sent cease and desist letters to prominent DNA testing companies. Then there are the privacy worries and whether someone's genetic information could leak out to insurance companies or employers. Lord acknowledges protecting genetic data is crucial to his company's reputation and future.
Privacy is to Navigenics like safety is to Volvo. We have to have, our brand is dependent on privacy and the integrity of privacy and security.
You've just shared a great deal of your genetic information with us. Do you have any privacy concerns sharing it with us and by extension, an audience across the country?
Obviously, I don't.
Mike Godfrey's confidence comes partially from the Genetic Non-Discrimination Privacy Act passed by Congress in 2008. It prohibits health insurers from denying coverage based solely on a person's genetic predisposition.
My feeling is that those laws will continue to be updated and that there won't be much risk to me in the future or to anybody who does this.
As he uses his genetic results to guide his health decisions, Godfrey's also a test subject. He's one of thousands of Navigenics clients who have volunteered to be monitored for the next 20 years as part of a scientific study. Its purpose? to find out how and if people change their lifestyles after finding out what's in their DNA.
Bring it all the way up.
For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Saul Gonzalez in Los Angeles.
In other news, a coalition of religious leaders expressed outrage after a new report from Physicians for Human Rights alleged that doctors and other medical professionals experimented on terrorism suspects being interrogated by the CIA. The National Religious Campaign Against Torture released a new video with prominent clergy condemning American-sponsored torture. The group renewed its call for a national commission to investigate whether the U.S. violated its own laws by using torture. Controversy continues to surround a proposal to build a mosque near the site of Ground Zero in New York. Protesters gathered in Manhattan to show their anger over the plans. They claim the mosque would be an insult to the victims of September 11th. The Community Board of Lower Manhattan has voted in favor of the project, which supporters say is intended to promote religious tolerance. And there's controversy around another New York landmark as well. The Empire State Building is often illuminated for special occasions, including Argentina's Independence Day, a celebration for singer Mariah Carey, and even the 60th anniversary of Communist China. But the skyscraper's owners turned down a request that the building be lit up for the centennial of Mother Teresa's birth in August. They said while they do sponsor displays for some religious holidays like Christmas and Hanukkah, they have a specific policy against honoring religious figures. The Virginia Supreme Court has reversed a lower court's decision in a property dispute between the Episcopal Diocese of Virginia and nine congregations that left the denomination. The churches in question include Truro and the Falls Church, two of the largest and most historic in the state. They left the Episcopal Church after the 2003 consecration of a gay bishop and affiliated with more conservative Anglican jurisdictions in Africa. A lower court agreed with their claim that millions of dollars in property belong to the exiting congregations and not the diocese. But the Virginia Supreme Court said that decision was wrong and sent it back for further review. In a separate case, the California Supreme Court has agreed to consider a similar dispute between the Episcopal Diocese of Los Angeles and a breakaway church in Orange County. In France, an event takes place every spring that's been described as perhaps the largest public expression of traditional Catholicism in the world. It's a three-day, 72-mile pilgrimage from Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris to the cathedral at Chartres. A history professor from New York City, who has made the pilgrimage several times, described the experience for us.
My name is John Rao. I'm associate professor of history at St. John's University. I've done the pilgrimage to Chartres about six or seven times. And the regular preparations involve making sure you've got the right footwear more than anything else. Being a New Yorker and not owning a car, I walk a lot. You've started from a point, Notre Dame, which has this extraordinary impact on you because of its beauty and because of the fervor of the people praying and singing in it, and what the architecture of the cathedral and the light passing through the windows does is it makes it clear that God, the Father of lights, provides us a world which was incredibly more diverse and beautiful than anyone might think. The route to Chartres begins the first morning mostly in Paris and the surrounding areas. When we're talking about the people who make up the pilgrimage, the first thing to note is that probably about 70% of them are young people, people in their late teens and in their early 20s. They're people from all over Europe. The majority are French, of course, but from every country that I can imagine, from Africa, from Asia, from the United States.
It's so clear. It's so sunny. By the afternoon, people are going to start suffering from the heat, you know? A big thing for people who haven't done before is just to get them to drink water.
The mass on the first day, it's usually in a field. The masses that are held during the pilgrimage and at Chartres itself are the traditional Latin mass, in other words, the liturgy before the reforms that are associated with Pope Paul VI. You have perhaps certainly at least 100 priests who are hearing confessions during all of this. And they're scattered all through these lunch scenes and in the woods and in little deserted areas. Their Catholicism is a fervent Catholicism, traditional in the sense that it's very much focused on a spirituality that uses the traditional liturgy of the church, takes that very seriously, the traditional devotions, the traditional Latin liturgy. And then they have to give communion to as many as 10,000 people. The pilgrimage began in the Middle Ages. Chartres was always an important place and had great meaning in the life of the Christian world in the Kingdom of France. Joan of Arc made this pilgrimage. Louis XIV, I believe, made the pilgrimage. The second day of the pilgrimage, the Mass is in the woods. Same kind of Mass, beautiful music, priests hearing confession.
My name is Michael Matt. I'm the head of the American contingent, the American chapter for the Chartres pilgrimage. It's definitely a youth movement. They very easily, in many instances, can really tap into this whole tradition, the foundation of the Catholic faith. It doesn't matter that they don't understand every word of the Latin. They're attracted to the sacrality of the liturgy. They're attracted to the rubric and to the ritual and to the idea of suffering for what you believe in. Can you smell the grass? Can you feel your feet? This is the real world, especially when you put rosaries into it and traditional masses and allegiance to the Holy Father. This is the real world that we're all seeking.
The entire pilgrimage is of an impact that's hard to describe. A pilgrimage is a microcosm of what life is. Life, from a Catholic standpoint, is a pilgrimage from birth to death, from our birth to our ultimate eternal experience with God. I find myself thinking about everything that I ought to do in life, everything that I've done wrong. I go back through all of the experiences of my life and where I thought that I should have done something better. The third day, the last day of the pilgrimage, everyone is exuberant because if you've made it to that last day, you know you're going to make it. You know you're really going to make it. You're in forest, you're in fields. Endless, endless fields. You at least get to see, after a certain point, the spires of Chartres in front of you. It can become particularly grueling because it takes a long time for that spire in the distance to really get truly bigger.
There was more of a maybe a penitential spirit yesterday, but today it's just joy. It's just joy.
When you get onto the roads in the real suburbs of Chartres, then you can see it looming more and more. And then you begin this walk, which is a last torturous walk up this long, shaded path that takes you up into the town itself. That's when you see it there, in all of its glory. What most stirs me up is the fact that you've managed to do it. You've managed to do it. You've finished it. When we're at Chartres, we have a solemn high mass, and all of this is surrounded with a great deal of ritual and ceremony. You could see 10,000 or 15,000 fervent Catholics, most of them young people, deeply committed to this traditional rite of mass. By the time it's over, the feeling of exaltation is hard to describe, just hard to describe. The newer generation found what that old rite had to offer, spiritually satisfying, spiritually uplifting, and in a way that you could see almost in no other event that took place in the annual life of the church. The entire 3 days is emotional. This spirit of pilgrimage should be continued on a day-to-day basis for the rest of your life.
That's our program for now. I'm Kim Lawton. There's much more on our website where you can comment on all of our stories and share them. Audio and video podcasts are also available, and you can always follow us on our Facebook page. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, music from St. Camillus Catholic Church in Silver Spring, Maryland, during the prayer vigil for the oil spill crisis.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.